So all the authority figures are in the trustees meeting, so now's our chance to take over. Talk is over. Let's get to work. My name is Alex, and this is a coming to the path talk, I guess. I'm sort of a local. I grew up in Hilton, about half an hour from here. As a child, I was very shy, awkward. Things like public speaking were out of the question, and I'm very nervous still. So I had a real hard time sort of making friends, and I always found social interaction terrifying, and sometimes still do. Things like talking on the telephone, I still find terrifying, and now I do it for a living. More or less. When I was young, I found my solace in things like Dungeons and Dragons and stuff like that, and escaped into a fantasy world and was able to carve out a little social niche there in that sort of area. All of that kind of all those games and things like that came to a pretty abrupt end when one day we were in one of my friend's basements doing that sort of thing, and another guy brought over a case of beer and some marijuana, and that may have been the last time that I played Dungeons and Dragons, because immediately I fell in love with being intoxicated. At first I didn't like drinking, but fell in love with the drugs right away. But the first time I got drunk, there were three of us, and we went to a park, and we had stolen a bottle of, I think it was black velvet, from someone's parents, and we were 17 or something like that, and the other two people got comfortably drunk and tipsy and had a good time, and when they were done, they knew when it was time to go home. I informed them that they were to leave me in the park. I would finish the bottle and I would figure something out, and they shouldn't worry about me. And that was pretty much the pattern of my drinking, for years. I graduated high school more or less by the skin of my teeth. I have no idea how I got handed a diploma. Because things like school, ceased to matter. One of the reasons I think I liked alcohol so much was that it allowed me to feel somewhat normal when I was interacting with my peers. Suddenly I had new friends and things like that. I say friends, but really, as time went on, I started to develop these behaviors where human beings ceased to be people to befriend and form relationships with, and they became sort of equipment for me to manipulate and get what I wanted or what I thought I needed. Somebody bring me a clock of some kind, please.
Sure.
Okay. Otherwise, we might be here all day, or I might just talk. Or I could talk for 10 minutes and just run away.
Maybe until like 10:20.
Yeah. Thank you. So I became very quickly very expert at finding the person who had the money or the booze or the drugs or who was throwing the party, and becoming their best friend at that time. And this was a skill I became quite expert at as time went on. After high school, I signed up for community college because you know, that's what I felt I was supposed to do. You finish high school and then you go to college and whatnot. So I signed up for NCC and I got on the RTS bus from Hilton and went every day to NCC, where I had signed up for all of these classes, but I didn't seem to make it to too many of them because I found a whole new set of people to fall in with who kind of had the same agenda that I did. So to this date, I've attended MCC twice and I have 0 credits still, and a lot of money in the hole because of that. And I quickly discovered that I didn't have to, you know, get off the bus downtown and catch the transfer over to MCC in Brighton. I could just walk over to Monroe Avenue and have some real fun over there. So that became my new stomping grounds, a couple of blocks from here. And you know, I made friends with mostly homeless guys. They became my new drinking buddies. They were old enough to purchase the alcohol and were more than happy to drink it with me. So we spent time on Cobb's Hill together. I learned how to panhandle. This is about age 18, 19. I became pretty involved with like punk rock subculture sort of stuff, and a lot of my friends had, you know, big orange mohawks and things like that, and there's a lot of loud, crazy music and lots of parties and drinking and things like that. My behavior while drinking seemed to shift slowly or less slowly, and it went from sort of comical things where I would you know, wrestle with furniture in the middle of the night and you know, have to go to the hospital with a bruised rib or something, urinating in places where I was not supposed to, silly things like that. Yeah, but it got messier later on. Had a real hard time sort of holding a job. Reality was really starting to slip away in a very real way. And I became extremely self-absorbed. And so I bounced around from place to place, lived in Brockport for a little while, and it was always... Wherever I lived became a flop house, and there were always piles of people there of various kinds, and it was very chaotic. Traveling sort of hobo types from out of town would, you know, come in riding on a train. You know, not like they bought a train ticket, like they would ride on, you know, in a boxcar and end up at my house somehow. So there were fights and lots of black eyes and broken glass and stuff like that. But like I said, after a while, my behavior ceased to become funny for a lot of people. It used to be that I would wake up, you know, sometime in the afternoon, and come out of my room and. Whoever was in the room would laugh at me, point at me and laugh, and, oh, ha, ha, this guy. And I would have no idea what they were talking about because, you know, I was a blackout drinker by this point in time. And, but eventually it started to be where I would come out, and the people around me would sort of look at me sideways, like really, what is wrong with him? Because, you know, I started becoming really nasty when I was drinking. I would say horrible things that I don't remember and that I would never say in my right state of mind to anybody. I became very sort of emotionally and sometimes physically abusive to friends and loved ones. I started having hospital stays where, you know, I would get so drunk that I would pass out in places where people shouldn't be falling asleep, like, you know, the corner of Chestnut and East Avenue. You know, and I would wake up in the hospital. And the doctors were telling me, you know, the serious damage that I was doing to my body, but at the time it didn't register at all. You know, they were telling me about, you know, the possibility of developing, you know, internal sort of varicose veins in my throat. Maybe I got that wrong, but they were telling me some pretty nasty stuff, and I wasn't listening. So all throughout this time, I'm experimenting with other things. I tried the, you know, customary LSD and all that kind of stuff. Played around with cocaine at parties and things. But at one point in time, I met a girl who was really into heroin. And so, you know, I was in love with her and she was in love with heroin, and I also became in love with heroin pretty fast. And this was a whole, really a different ball game. There's no feelings when you're on that stuff, and you don't really care about a whole lot. You really, truly don't care about other human beings and what effect you're having on them at all when you're doing that. And that's really what it was like. You know, I stole from everyone around me and, you know, did terrible, terrible things. I made most of my money. I worked full-time during this time period. And, you know, I would get my paycheck and it would be gone by noon. So the rest of the week, I made my money. You know, if you're ever getting off the 490 off-ramp there by Goodman Street and you see somebody holding a sign that says, I need food, or please help any way you can, or whatever, I did that a few hours every day, and it was actually quite lucrative. So that kept me in what I needed. You know, because after a while, I developed a habit, and I needed these substances to continue to function and not become seriously ill. So I was injecting every single day heroin and cocaine, sometimes together. You know, walking from the Goodman Street off-ramp over to North Clinton Avenue and, say, Avenue A, every single day, four or five times. So I got a lot of exercise at that time. So it, you know, this kind of thing eventually catches up with people. And I'm very grateful that I'm not very tough. You know, I know people that still are in this lifestyle, and they continue to do it for years and decades. Luckily, I'm kind of a wuss, and I couldn't hang like that. So what ended up happening, I was hanging out with two other sort of using buddies, and we were riding around in a stolen car. This one girl had stolen a car. And the other guy was, you know, the booster. He would steal infant formula from Wegmans or razors or video games or whatever we could get our hands on, really. And I was the guy who was renting a room, so everyone had a place to sleep and, you know, headquarters. I was renting a room for $75 a week over off of Blossom Road. And, you know, the police caught on to what was going on. I think we were at I forget what store we were at, but the guy came running out and said, yeah, the cops are on their way, and we got to get out of here. And so we found ourselves on 104 with police cars behind us, lights on. And the driver of the car, she said, okay, we're going to pull over, and when he gets out of the car, we're just going to go. And me and the other guy said, no, please don't do that. But that's what she did, and she hit the gas, and now we find ourselves in a sort of car chase. But not a car chase like you see on TV, because this was 104 in Webster at like rush hour. So we were at a very slow speed car chase. Kind of crawling along. The cops are behind us waiting for an opportunity. They got their opportunity. We tried to pull off onto some other road or something. And they rammed us, bringing us to a stop. Quicker than someone could run up to the Dokes online, the cop is out of his car, and he had smashed the driver's side window with his gun, cut his hand, and they sort of dragged us all off through the windows, and I found myself handcuffed, face down, on the expressway, police cars everywhere, lights on, in the rain. And, I had been up injecting cocaine for 3 days. It was about this time of year, actually. It was right about Halloween. And thinking back, I should have been panicking. I should have been freaking out, hyperventilating a little, kind of like I'm doing now. I should have been very, very uncomfortable. But instead, everything was very still. I felt completely at peace. And, the girl looked over at me. She's handcuffed face down. She said, I'm sorry. I said, it's okay. Somehow I knew that something was going to change. Either I was going to go to prison for a long time, or... something was going to change. I was going to die. It just wasn't going to continue to go on like this. And that wasn't the case right away. I kept on going for a little while. I was charged with a felony, and all these things. So instead of, facing the music directly, I decided that I would try another dodge move, and I would go to rehab, and that would get him off my back for a while. So I went to rehab with no intentions of stopping or changing my lifestyle or anything like that. And I ended up being in this, at the time the rehab program was 14 days. That's all you got, 14 days. Somehow I ended up spending something like 45 days in this 14-day drug rehab program. And, they would bring in AA meetings from the outside, people who, were involved with Alcoholics Anonymous and were, spending their free time going into rehab centers and talking to messed up people like myself. And so as, a little time passed, and I thought to myself, well, injecting these hard drugs into my veins every day has really messed me up, so I'm going to stop doing that. But when I get out of here, I'm going to get so drunk. And then a little more time passed, and, the fog lifted a little, and I said, well, drinking has always been a real problem with me. It's messed up all of my sort of human relationships, and I should really stop doing that. But when I get out of here, I'm going to smoke a pound of weed. It's going to be awesome. And then, finally I realized that recovery was a sort of complete package kind of thing, and there wasn't any wiggle room there. And so I was released actually to this nun's house. She was a nun. She was sort of an excommunicated nun. She was part of the, if anyone remembers, the split in the Corpus Christi church some number of years ago. She was part of the people who were kicked out for acting like good Christians. And so she had her house there where where she lived. It wasn't like, you know, where she went to work every day. She lived here, and she opened up her house to three or four addicted people who either came directly out of jail or directly out of rehab. And this woman really had something. She knew when you were lying to her, and I know because I lied to her, and she knew every single time. She always seemed to know where you were, and she had us follow a schedule every day. And when I say a schedule, I mean every half hour of the day was, you know, chopped up into something. There was no wiggle room there. At the time, it was exactly what I needed. And so I was going to two AA meetings a day and outpatient rehab and all this stuff. And I became very, pretty involved in AA. Right about this time, she had on her bookshelf this very, really terrible translation of the Tao Te Ching. I never know if I'm saying that right. But you know the book I'm talking about, the Lao Tzu. It was a very bad Christianized translation of this, but something about it really grabbed me, and I carried this thing around with me everywhere I went, and I was always like reading out of it to people who didn't want to listen to me read out of it, and pushing it on them and telling them it was the greatest thing ever. So that was my sort of introduction to Eastern thought or spirituality, I guess. Actually, not quite the first encounter. Let me back up all the way back to high school, to the beginning of the talk here. I did have an encounter with Buddhism. I became interested in Buddhism. I took a book off one of my teacher's shelves and carried that around me everywhere I went, and considered myself a Buddhist for, you know, a couple of weeks even. And I remember, for the Buddha's birthday, where we go and we pour tea over the baby Buddha, I had read something about this in the book, and so I remember bringing this little Buddha, but it was like, you know, the portly Chinese restaurant, like happy Buddha guy. So I brought him in a little box to the lunchroom, and you know, me and my friends poured tea over this little tiny red Buddha statue, and everybody was very impressed with my knowledge of Buddhism at the time. Anyway, so I started frequenting the sort of used bookstores around town and snatching up books on Taoism and Buddhism and meditation. The first book on meditation I ever read was Joseph Goldstein's The Experience of Insight, you know, sort of Vipassana manual of sorts. And you know, I would try it from time to time. I would sit down and I would follow the instructions for a couple of minutes, and you know, usually I would go, well, nothing's happening, this isn't working, I must not be doing it right, and I would go read some more Buddhist philosophy or something like that and put the book down. At one point, somebody informed me that there was a meditation center in the city of Rochester that I had never known about, the Rochester Zen Center. And so I hopped on my bike. At this time, I lived in a halfway house over on Alphonse Street, which is near the corner of Clifford and Hudson Avenue. So it was quite a bike ride over here. And this is quite a different neighborhood than over there, I gotta say. And so I rolled down here and actually rode past the Zen Center a couple of times. I was looking for some Chinese-looking temple or something like that. But I eventually noticed the little sign and rang the doorbell. And Errol answered the door. And so she was the first person I encountered here. She talked to me briefly, and you know, the phone was ringing off the hook. She couldn't really spend much time, but she gave me the little workshop brochure, and I brought it home and promptly forgot about it for a couple of months. Eventually came to a workshop. You know, I was like, that's fantastic. I'm going to do this. I'm a Zen Buddhist now for keeps. And so I went home and proceeded to attempt to meditate for a few minutes, and I would say, man, this is not working, nothing's happening, and I would stop. It took me about 6 months to come back to the Zen Center, and for a beginner's night. My beginner's night happened to be the same day as the Bodhidharma ceremony, so I got here and they're doing this crazy ceremony and everything's all set up, and I thought, wow, this is awesome. I thought that's what you guys did every day here, was a ceremony, and there were cool paintings everywhere. But I started coming pretty frequently in the mornings and sometimes in the evenings. I wasn't working at the time, so I had a lot of time to come to formal sittings. So I did for a while. Still doing the AA meetings. I developed a lot of ideas about Buddhism and myself and how great a Buddhist I was and how I was going to save all the sentient beings. At the same time in these AA meetings, they're talking to me about the 12 steps and how I need to do them. And if, I don't do them, there's a good chance that I'm not going to be able to resist temptation to go back to the other life. And I had myself convinced that, because I was meditating and I was doing this thing, that I didn't need that stuff and all that talk about God and hard personal inventories and making amends and all that kind of stuff. I would just sit and I would save all the sentient beings and that would be it. Turned out that wasn't a good way to go, because I'm walking down the street one day and I look down and there's a dollar bill all kind of bunched up, and I didn't have a lot of dollar bills around me at the time, so like anybody would, I picked it up, and inside this dollar bill was a rather sizable bag of cocaine kind of balled up in there, or what appeared to be cocaine. It was. I stuck it in my pocket and kept on walking and kind of wiggled my finger around in there and tasted it, and I said, yep, that's what it is. And I went home and did a big line of it, and I said, yep, that's really what it is. And then I went down to Rite Aid and got a bag of needles, and I was off. And, it got pretty nasty, and I was only really using for a couple of days. They say in AA often that, if you go back out there and start using or drinking again, you pick up right where you left off. And I found that to be true, and it was really, I used more in 48 hours than I'd ever done in a single run before. My arms were destroyed, my veins, and I had bruises and marks everywhere, and developed a pretty serious sort of staph infection in my left arm. Which I didn't know what it was at the time. I just knew that my arm hurt so bad and I couldn't move it. So I went to the hospital and, they took me in, looked at me, and set me up with a room, told me what was wrong with me and that I would be there for a few days on an antibiotic drip. I had the feeling I might be in the hospital for a couple of days, so I brought some books with me. I brought my AA book, and I brought one of my Zen books. I think it was the Charles Luck Zen, one of those Zen books, volume something. It wasn't like a big aha moment or an epiphany or anything. It was just kind of like, oh, well, maybe I should just, take people's advice and do these 12 steps and keep sitting, and maybe I'll get better and stop being such an asshole. So that's what I did. I went out and I found myself a sponsor, which is something that was terrifying to me, walking up to somebody and asking them, at an AA meeting, saying, hey, will you be my sponsor? Just to put that out there, that's terrifying to me. To ask for help really is terrifying to me still. And so we went through this stuff, and you know, the fearless, to use the AA words, you know, the fearless and searching moral inventory of oneself, and admitting one's faults to another, and going around making amends, which, you know, popular culture will tell you that means you go up to the person who you robbed or beat up and say, "Hey, I was a real jerk back then, and I'm sorry." The reality is, it's not what an amends is at all. You have to go up and say, "Hey, I was a jerk, and I'm sorry, and here's your money back." And so I did a good bit of that sort of thing, and I have people today in my life who are consider themselves my friend, and by all logical standards, you know, they probably should never talk to me again. But they forgave me, you know, and it was amazing. While I was in the halfway house, you know, I was in there with 23 other people. It would be kind of like living at the Zen Center, except everybody is, you know, like fresh off the streets in recovery. So it was pretty crazy. But it was there that, you know, I sort of learned, in this house full of thieves, drug dealers, murderers, you know, and anything else you can imagine, I saw the most heartfelt sincerity, generosity, and selflessness that I ever experienced from other people in my entire life. And these were, you know, what society considers the scum of the earth. So that kind of, you know, threw me for a little spiritual loop. And, you know, when I first started practicing Zen, I was really doing it because I could not get a handle on my thoughts, feelings, and actions, and I wanted to stop being this sort of tornado ripping through other people's lives, and I wanted to stop making myself miserable. And that was my purpose for sitting. You know, that's still one of the reasons I sit now. Somewhere along the way, I came to believe that in that one thing that Roshi says that we have to have faith in, the only thing that, and I hope I don't mess this up, that when Shakyamuni Buddha said that all beings are inherently enlightened and perfectly endowed with wisdom and compassion, that he was neither mistaken nor lying. And I know Roshi borrowed that from someone else too. And I believe that. So eventually my life circumstances, I always wanted to come train, you know, this whole time that I've been sitting. I thought that the people who live here were magical, perfect, bodhisattvic beings, and I wanted to like join the party. And you are, and you know, everybody is, and you know, we're human too, and we do human things. But yeah, my life circumstances sort of came together, the planets were aligned or whatever, and I found myself in a position where I could just, you know, come train, and I didn't have any sort of worldly or society sort of things holding me back from it. So, you know, I jumped into it. Along the way, while training, through a variety of circumstances, I became politically active, something I always sort of had a passion for, but never really knew how to get involved. And also, most of my life I was too busy being a selfish jerk and drinking and making other people's lives miserable. So really do anything of that nature. And so, practice for me now really does happen in two ways. It's on the cushion and it's out there trying to accompany people who are, experiencing oppression, I guess. And I have to do my best to make those two things not to. It's really, really difficult sometimes to sort of juggle and balance these things. But I really don't see a way for me to cut either one of those things out or even down, really. So I feel a need to practice Zen, and I feel a need to be involved in activist things. And really the reason for that, and I jotted down a couple of things so I wouldn't forget them. Shakyamuni Buddha said upon his enlightenment that all human beings are inherently enlightened, perfectly endowed with compassion and wisdom, and also half of the world's food supply is thrown away while millions of people starve. We're all perfectly enlightened, and there are at least five, if not more, empty houses for every homeless person in the United States. 2/3 of the women in Kenya will be raped during their lifetime. And by the beginning of the next century, due to man-made climate change, entire populations will be left without fresh water. And that's inevitable already from what we've already caused. And so, there's the point of practice. Like, if we're all perfectly enlightened, the question is, what the hell, really, sometimes, for me. And so I try and let that, remind me. And I'm very good at just tracking myself and, not keeping practice or world stuff at the forefront of my mind. I can find a million ways not to think about either one of those things, and it's a human thing to do, to be distracted. I have water here. I wish I remembered that 20 minutes ago. With that, John said I should open up the thing to any questions, comments, or accusations for a couple of minutes. And somebody like Truman, when it's time, can you just stop people from asking the questions? I don't know when.
Sure, yeah, no, we have time. We've got at least 5 to 10 minutes.
Okay.
I'm just going to get up and close the window a bit.
Duane.
If I might ask a potentially deeply personal question. You remember what you felt like the first time you made amends to someone and they forgave you?
I felt really powerful, actually. If I remember correctly, the first time I made amends to somebody, I made amends to them. This was a particularly... I won't even go into the details of what I did to this person, because it sucked. And I approached them and made amends to them. And when you make amends, you put it in that person's hands. What you say, what can I do to make this better? And their response was just keep doing what you're doing, which is they made it very easy on me. But I felt powerful. I made amends to this person, and then I went and asked this other girl on a date right away, which is something that I was terrified to do. So I felt really sort of empowered.
And Deborah.
Where were your parents when all this was going on.
Ha! That's, yeah, how did I leave that out? So, yeah, that's a really big part of my story that I completely left out. My parents, at one point in time, I stole some very, very important pieces of jewelry from them, not knowing exactly what they were. And when I found out what they were, I was ashamed and terrified, and I left home for 10 years. I made no contact with any member of my family, no blood relative, for 10 years, which was a... It honestly saved them from a lot of things that I would have put them through, but at the same time, they didn't know where I was. It wasn't until I was in recovery for a couple of years that we were sort of reunited, and we always had a rocky relationship, like, my entire life, and now we get along better than we ever have, and my relationship with my family is, I'm really grateful that they're in my life now.
Siblings? Do you have any siblings?
Yeah, I have one brother, and we're sort of like, you know, two halves of something. I can't think of a good metaphor, but he was like football player in high school, joined the army, like went to Kuwait and served, and I think at one point in time even attempted to become a cop. So he and I get along great now too, and we used to like fist fight on a regular basis. So he's much bigger than me now, so I'm happy that we get along. It's my younger brother by 2 years.
Did you break up with him too for 10 years?
Yes. Yeah. My mother actually at one point in time, she told me later on, she says, "Don't tell your father, but I hired a private investigator to track you down at one point." And they followed me to, up to a certain point to this one apartment, and then they lost the trail. Apparently, I was slippery.
But actually, Alex, what I really meant to ask you, well, I've got two things on mind. One is, it does feel to me like when it was just this big sense of relief when you got busted. You were lying on the floor, like something had to change. It was almost as if you were relieved that someone finally stopped, like you stopped yourself, but some outside force came in and it allowed you to move on to something else.
I've never really been able to put my finger on like what that feeling was. It was extremely bizarre, and I can really only describe it as a moment of grace. Because it wasn't just relief, you know, and I'd felt relief before. My normal reaction to relief is like, ah, they're off my back for a little while, I can get a little rest and then keep sort of scamming people. You know, this was very different, and I don't know really quite what it was, but I'm glad, you know, I'm really glad to have been charged with a felony.
And my other question is, he's not here in the Zendo, but there's one of your high school students, teachers, David Rockford.
Yes.
Who comes now. Can you talk a little bit about that? Do you remember anything in high school with him?
David, and he insists I call him David because I used to run into him like at the movies. After he started coming here to the center and say, Rookberg, and he said, can you please call me David? Yeah. So David I had him as an English teacher for 3 out of 4 years of high school, and he was really kind of a mentor to me. As much as someone in my mind state could have any kind of mentor, I wasn't hearing anything. You know, he would show us like Noam Chomsky videos in class, something that probably bugged the hell out of my father. And that first book on Buddhism that I had read, I actually took off his bookshelf without his permission. I probably never returned it, so if David's listening to this, I owe you whatever a book on Buddhism in 1996 cost.
I'm grateful you found your way here.
Thanks.
Yeah, I have to say it's probably one of the most harrowing coming to the path talks I've ever heard. Like, how is this going to end?
I want to mention Donna Diaz, who I forgot to talk about. When I came here, I'm still terrified of Roshi and, sometimes just authority in general. And so, especially when I first started coming here, I didn't have many encounters with Roshi, a little bit with John, but Donna, if anybody who doesn't know her, was a priest here, and she moved back to Mexico a few years back. And sometimes I would get up early in the morning and come to the morning sitting just to get a hug from Donna, because there's something about her hugs that were somehow some kind of energy transfer there. And she was really just so supportive, advice on practice, even just, I would come to sit and she would come running out of, her room or the reception office or wherever she was in the center with a bag of like stuff that she would just give me, candy and stuff like that. And when I relapsed, I came back to the center and I showed her my arm and I said, Donna, look what I did. I really messed up and, I'm covered in bruises and track marks. And she just kind of like, I can't describe it. She just kind of rubbed my arm and comforted me. And, it was the right response that I needed at the time. She was really good like that. When she left, she gave me this mala that I still have, this nice sort of Tibetan looking mala.
What are some projects that are near and dear to your heart, outside the center, or even, bringing Buddhism out, just things you're involved in, if you'd like to, share?
The tricky thing with Buddhism and political work for me is not to always be the Buddhist in any given project. I'm involved in a lot of sort of housing organizing, people who are in foreclosure, who have many times been fraudulently foreclosed on by their bank or whatever scummy organization has bought their mortgage at the time. So I'm involved in a lot of work around that, resistance to that sort of thing. I work with an anarchist group, Rochester Red and Black. That's my shout out to my comrades. And so the Buddhist piece for me in this stuff is learning how to not lead or proselytize in any way, politically or spiritually, but learning how to accompany people in their struggles, for it not to be about me and not to be about convincing somebody of an ideology, but learning where the lack is, learning where pain is being caused, and it just kind of trying to make myself available and develop skills that are useful in sort of remedying some of these really difficult to solve, enormous problems that it's like, dumping snow into a well, over and over and over again, really.
Mm-hmm.
Alex.
So Buddhism says that the cause of our sorrow, of our suffering, is the three, I think they're called the three poisons, greed, anger, and delusion. So would you say that the cause of your own sorrow with with abusing drugs and alcohol was that? Greed, anger, and delusion?
Yes. It's a short answer.
Good.
Yes.
Well, we are actually running out of time, so maybe one more question. If not, then we'll recite the vows. Dwayne?
Would you like to say something about your work with writing prisoners?
Yeah. You know, when I first came on staff, there was a little shelf in the reception office at the time that said prison work, and I said, prison work? What is the prison work? That sounds like something I want to get involved in. And you know, eventually I gained permission. People who are incarcerated sometimes write to the Zen Center, and just, you know, blindly they find a spiritual center, and they become interested in Zen, and they say, Rochester Zen Center, let me send a letter there and see what happens. And so we get them from time to time. In between me and Brenda Reed, we respond to them. Reading these letters and corresponding with people that are incarcerated and are practicing Zen inside prison has been one of the most inspirational things I've ever been able to do. One of the gentlemen I've been writing with 14 years ago or so was involved in a double homicide, a really, really nasty, you know, throat slashing double homicide, and he'll never leave prison. He's there for the rest of his life. And just reading how somebody in that kind of situation practices Zen is a really good antidote to my own sort of like little quibbles about whatever, I guess, any difficulties that I might be having with my own practice are made to feel a little bit softer. And I guess that's a really sort of selfish thing I'm taking away from it, but that's what it is. Just amazing sort of transformation that this practice can do for somebody who, you know, is a murderer and is in the worst possible environment. You know, the people around him are not trying to make themselves better, a lot of them. So that's, I'm glad I don't have to sit there myself.
Okay, thanks, Alex.